Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated April 22nd. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Starting above the fold today, report, Credit Forcing Jobs to Poorer Areas, by Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. North Carolina Department of Commerce officials appear to be doing a better job getting business tax credit incentives into the state's poorer counties. In 2008, according to a recent report, the state's poorer and mid-ranked counties got 65% of the credits awarded for job creation and investing in business property. The numbers stand in sharp contrast to the often repeated criticism that North Carolina's key economic development programs have pumped most of their largesse into the richest regions of the state. Some observers, however, are not convinced. A single year's worth of data isn't enough to say that old pattern has been broken. I'd like to look and see after 2 or 3 years, says E. Brent Lane, director of the UNC Chapel Hill Carolina Center for Competitive Economies. Lane has worked as a consultant hired to study the impact of North Carolina incentives programs. Another problem, Lane adds, is that 2008 was a down year for the economy, for business expansion, and for the issuing of credit incentives in general. That's another reason why you have to look at the longer period of time, he says. The 2008 credits were issued in the second year of the operation of the state's Article 3J program, which replaced the old William S. Lee credit system that ran in North Carolina between 1996 and 2006. It was criticism over the disproportionate flow of business credits into the most affluent counties, including Wake, Durham, Orange, and Mecklenburg, that prompted the changeover. Under Lee, the state's 100 counties had been divided into five tiers based on various economic factors. The rich counties, numbering at times between 19 and 21, were in Tier 5. Between 2002 and 2006, 50% of credits awarded for creating jobs, investing in machinery and other things went to firms in Tier 5 counties. Enter the 3J program. Under it, the five tiers were slashed to three. Making up Tier 3, however, are the same group of the state's 19 most affluent counties. In 2008, Tier 3 got 34.9% of credits, a good 15 percentage points below the historical average. Tier 1, now with 40 of the poorest counties, got 56.5% of credits, and Tier 2, with 41 of the next poorest counties, got 14.3%. All told, the 2008 incentive awards were tied to the creation of 6,372 jobs, 3,249 in the richer Tier 3 counties, and 3,123 in tiers with the less affluent counties. North Carolina Department of Commerce Deputy Secretary Dale Carroll, agreeing with Lane, says it's hard to draw conclusions based on a year's worth of data. It's just a snapshot, he says, adding that the 3J program, set up before the current administration took office, had as one of its goals the sparking of more development in rural areas of the state. The way it does that is by providing a bonus to the companies that set up shop in poorer counties. For every job created in a rural county, for example, the potential credit is $12,500. In a wealthier county, the figure is $750. Companies in the poorer counties can also receive credits for buying real estate and a larger credit, 7% versus 3.5%, on purchases of business property. Even if the 2008 3J numbers don't prove conclusively that the state has bridged the rich-poor gap, what isn't in doubt, says Carroll, is that having the credits on the books remains one of the state's most important recruiting tools. Commerce staffers in talks with corporate prospects routinely include tax credit estimates in the list of possible relocation or expansion benefits. We need every tool we can get, especially in these times, he says. The 2008 3J report was released to the legislative subcommittee that is reviewing all of the state's natural and economic resources programs to see which can be put on the North Carolina chopping block. North Carolina's long-running business incentive programs are one of the items under review. "We're looking at everything," says committee co-chair Steve LaRocque, a Kinston Republican. "We have to. We don't have a choice." Next up, wages for North Carolina chancellors lag, by Jason DeBrune, from Raleigh. Chancellors of North Carolina's public universities rank in the bottom half of total compensation nationally and earn nearly half of what chancellors at some comparable universities are in other states are paid. Among the leaders of the state's public universities, only Holden Thorpe of UNC Chapel Hill and Erskine Bowles, head of the UNC system, came with a total cost of employment of higher than $400,000 in the 2009-10 school year. Randy Woodson of North Carolina State University would have been the third to claim that distinction, but he was not appointed until April 1, 2010. During the remainder of the fiscal year, which ended June 30, 2010, he earned $105,000. The compensation figures were compiled by the Chronicle of Higher Education, a news source for college and university faculty and administrators. The publication, based in Washington, D.C., broke down compensation into two areas: total compensation and total cost of employment. Total compensation factors in the amount of base pay, bonuses, and deferred compensation a president actually collected in 2009 and 10 fiscal year. Total cost of employment includes all money the university and state set aside for the president during the fiscal year. Members of the UNC Board of Governors were not made available for comment, but in an email, UNC System spokeswoman Joni Worthington explained that the salary ranges are based on benchmarking data from other public universities across the country that have been designated as peer institutions by the UNC Board of Governors, end quote. She went on to explain that chancellors of campuses with the same classification receive a common salary range, so Thorpe and Woodson receive a similar pay package. "We certainly spend a lot of time thinking about it, and we are where we ought to be," says Bob Winston, a member of the UNCCH Board of Trustees. Still, Winston said he and the other trustees are aware of public perception, especially at a time when the state is staring at huge budget deficits. At some universities around the nation, schools have gotten ahead of themselves in terms of pay for their top executives, he says. "You've got to be careful about that." By comparison, chancellors at North Carolina's private universities earn more than their counterparts in the public system. Duke University's president, Richard H. Broadhead, had a total compensation of $824,755 in the 2008 and 9 school year, up from $697,221 in 2007 and 8, and $663,506 in 2006 and 7. Wake Forest University President Nathan O. Hatch had a total pay package of $832,324, and Meredith College President Maureen A. Hartford earned $311,041 in 2008 and 9, according to Chronicle's research. Hartford will retire at the end of this school year. Compared with the executive salaries at other private sector universities, pay packages for UNC system chancellors fall short as well. A typical CEO would earn $364,632 on the low end, $701,036 in the mid-range, and $1.1 million on the high end, said Lauren Kesterson, vice president of operations for MRI Network, Management Recruiters of Raleigh, who gathered and compared salaries of private sector CEOs. She pointed out that there are several factors, such as size of the company, tenure with the organization, and the industry, that determine pay for top executives. In North Carolina, Winston thinks public university compensation is where it should be. "We should be paying the amount that it takes to get and keep good chancellors," he said. "It should send a message that we are paying our chancellor for the responsibility that he is taking on and the importance of that job," end quote. Co-chairs of the standing North Carolina Senate Committee on Higher Education, Senators Gene Preston, Dan Sosik, Jerry Tillman, and Tom Apodaca, all Republicans did not return multiple calls and emails seeking comment. Winston said he has never received any pressure from the General Assembly in regard to compensation for school officials. And now the lead article on the front page, Private Pleasures. How two clubs that cater to NCSU alumni are finding ways to survive in a down economy. By Chris Basden. From Raleigh. While they may compete for members from the same collegial family, you'd be hard-pressed to find two clubs with strategies as different as the NC State University Club and the State Club. The latter, with its swanky foyer and winding staircase, caters to the needs of university and corporate representatives on official business. The former builds its brand around family-friendly amenities, including swimming pools, a kids' playground, and events such as breakfast with Easter Bunny and a bingo night. The contrasts are stark, but after enduring tough stretches in the recent past, both clubs appear to have found their own paths to recovery. The University Club is fresh off a $4.5 million renovation that significantly updated the facility for the first time in 50 years, and is gearing up for a new $1.8 million fundraiser that would fuel additional improvements. The work is part of a capital improvement plan that was hatched to save the club from deteriorating into irrelevancy. The Hillsborough Street-based club first opened its doors in 1959 as a perk for faculty, but eventually allowed both staff and alumni to join. Without significant updates, interest in the University Club began to wane in recent years. Membership dropped to 645 in 2005, and club officials began worrying about the venue's viability. So they explored ways to update the facility, which offers dining areas, tennis courts, a 9-hole golf course, and swimming pools. The first phase of the overhaul took about 18 months and was funded by a $4 million loan from First Citizens Bank, $3 million of which was guaranteed by the North Carolina State Foundation. The club also chipped in $500,000 in cash. Those improvements, which were mostly complete by last November, include a new front entrance, a kitchen expansion, a new pool, and renovations to existing rooms. It has a new attitude, says Phil Jones, the building committee chairman. It has so much more energy. The $1.8 million second phase primarily will consist of new construction, including adding an outdoor pavilion near the pool and, separately, building a casual dining facility with a sports bar theme. The existing bar also will be transformed into a conference room. In the wake of the makeover, membership has risen to 963, an all-time high, according to Jones. But retaining those members in the years ahead will be key. The club needs at least 800 for its current financial model to work. Much needed as they may have been, the renovations came with a high price tag. Monthly dues are now around $140, and members have a $90 quarterly food minimum. Dues were around $85 about 5 years ago. For a private club, this venue has a blue-collar sensibility. At the University Club, there's no pretentiousness, says General Manager Jim Aspley. A 2009 tax return shows that the nonprofit University Club posted nearly $2.3 million in revenue compared to $1.6 million in expenses. The University Club is separate from the State Club, which is located on Centennial Campus's Alumni Drive. That much newer venue, which offers dining and meeting space amenities, also has had its own financial struggles in the recent past, including posting an operating loss of $93,300 on $1.5 million in revenue in 2008. General Manager Rick Cederholt has cut expenses since then, including trimming about four positions in 2009. The State's club revenue dropped to $1.3 million, but the cost-cutting helped put the club back in the black. While the 2010 audit isn't complete, preliminary numbers show a rebound, with revenue clocking in at $1.6 million, compared to expenses of $1.3 million. Cederholt says the State club has just over 580 members. Does NCSU need two such clubs, especially considering the financial issues they've both had over the years? Cederholt thinks so, citing the University Club's focus on families and his venue's concentration on more business-oriented members. It's different, Cederholt says. It's apples and oranges. Still on the front page, below the fold, Feds may put Four Oaks under additional scrutiny. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. Johnston County-based Four Oaks Bank says it expects to come under heightened scrutiny from state and federal banking regulators. The $974 million community lender with five branch offices in Wake County says a, quote, formal agreement, end quote, between it, the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, and the North Carolina Office of Commissioner of the Banks should be in place during the first half of the year. Regulators use such agreement as a general roadmap for banks to boost capital, review lending policies, and beef up management practices. Such deals also require bank managers to obtain the approval of regulators before paying out shareholder dividends. Four Oaks disclosed the pending agreement in a recent letter to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC, adding that examiners from the Richmond FED were wrapping up a review of the bank's financials. CEO Aidan Lee has said Four Oaks Bank, though, well capitalized according to key ratios, has been actively assessing its alternatives for improving capital, end quote. He declined to be interviewed about the bank's recent regulatory filings. Four Oaks, with 18 total offices, saw its net losses triple to $25 million in 2010 as problem loans, mostly in construction and real estate, jumped 122% to $44 million. Charge-offs of bad loans jumped to nearly 190% to $27 million for the year. The numbers, reflecting the bank's condition as of December 31, 2010, were compiled by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, also known as FDIC, and are the latest available. Publicly traded Four Oaks has delayed the release of its 2010 annual report. Four Oaks shares are lightly traded at around $2.75. According to Yahoo Finance, which listed the bank's 52-week range as being from $2.50 to $5.50. In an SEC filing last September, bank officials first reported that Four Oaks had inked a memo of understanding with regulators in July 2010. Such memos are the first stage of regulatory intervention. The drafting of a formal agreement represents a step up in the process. Banks can remain under such formal agreements for as little as 9 months and as long as 2 years, says independent bank consultant and former regulator Don Coker. It all depends on how long it takes them to accomplish the corrective action, Coker says. Banks generally don't disclose the fact that they are coming under an agreement before the fact. What's different in the case of Four Oaks this time around, however, was an exchange of letters subsequently made public between the bank and its security regulator, the SEC. After a routine check of the bank's 2009 annual report and three of its 2010 quarterly statements, SEC asked Four Oaks to clarify a list of items in its public documents. Among them were the bank's deeply discounted acquisition price of Garner-based Nuestro Banco, how it discloses the types of loans in the Four Oaks portfolio, and how it reports on the loans it has restructured with borrowers. Four Oaks also was asked to provide a detailed disclosure of its memo of understanding with regulators. It was in responding to the SEC on that last point that CFO Nancy Wise disclosed the new agreement with state and federal regulators. In future filings, she added, the company will provide more prominent disclosure of the material provisions of the MOU and other such agreements, including detailed disclosure of the terms contained in them and how they have affected the company's ability to pay dividends. Next up, Census adds space to bolster R&D work. By Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. Smart grid technology company Census quietly is plotting an expansion strategy that could accommodate as many as 200 additional workers in the future. The Raleigh company has signed a deal to occupy an additional 60,000 square feet of research and development space in the Keystone Technology Park in Durham. The company already occupies 18,000 square feet in two office buildings in nearby Perimeter Park in Morrisville, and the lease for both of those buildings has an expiration date of June 30, 2016, according to Wake County records. Census officials say they have not yet finalized plans for how the company will use the additional space for its R&D efforts. This was a preemptive measure, says Rita Simonetta, a spokeswoman. We're probably busting at the seams here. Census employs 262 people at its headquarters in North Raleigh and at its research and development office in Morrisville. And it has been signaling that more local growth could be on the way either through expansion or the relocation of Census employees from other locations. Census employs about 4,000 people worldwide. Census continually has been growing its Triangle employee base since a group of investors acquired Raleigh's Envis metering systems in 2003. As of April 20th, Census had 26 job listings on its career website for openings at its Raleigh and Morrisville offices. Pike Research estimates that 57.9 million smart meters are already planned to be installed by more than 90 utilities in the United States over the next few years. About 50% of all U.S. households are expected to switch to electric smart meters by 2020. Census is gunning to gain market share in electric smart meter sales while simultaneously expanding its expertise to go after the next frontier for smart meters, water utilities. Raleigh-based Census has surpassed its biggest competitors, Landis Gear and Itron, for the number one spot in market share for smart meter deployment in the world, according to a Pike Research report. Census had about a 25% of the global share market. The company is one of the leaders in a cluster of Triangle communities involved in the ongoing upgrade of the electrical power system using digital technology, including ABB, Alcatel-Lucent, Cisco Systems, Concert, Eaton, Elster, Progress Energy, SAS, Siemens, and Tantalus Systems. As of the end of the third quarter, Census had more than 8 million smart meter devices installed with 225 electric, water, and gas utility companies, Census President and CEO Peter Main said during a conference call in December. John Quealy, an analyst for Canaccord Genuity, who attracts the sustainability business markets, says that about 185 million electric smart meters already have been deployed across North America, which accounts for about 30 to 40% of electric utility customers. We're in the fourth or fifth inning for deploying different types of smart metering in the U.S., so we're pretty far along in that cycle, Quealy says. Census has done a solid job domestically growing market share. They are winning business in the states, he says. The bigger challenge for Census, Quealy says, is carrying that success overseas into Europe and Asia. They've got to look outside the U.S. for growth, and that's going to be a challenge for Census. Census also is banking on the growth of the smart meter technology for the water utility industry to keep its momentum. Census, in October, won a contract to sell 28,000 commercial water meters to a state-owned utility in Egypt. Closer to home, Carrier Town officials in November selected Census's technology for deployment of a $27.5 million fixed-base wireless meter reading system that will install 60,000 smart meter endpoints for its water utility customers. Growing with Care, IEM embarks on second expansion, by Monica Chin. From Durham, Global Emergency Planning Company, IEM Incorporated, is planning to double its workforce in Research Triangle Park by the end of this year, part of the second phase of the company's six-year expansion in the park. IEM will add 50 employees to its current total of more than 50 and expand into an additional 5,500 square feet at 2400 Ellis Road in Durham. Currently, the company resides in 7,500 square feet. IEM, which stands for Innovative Emergency Management, relocated its headquarters from Baton Rouge, Louisiana in August 2010. The company has announced plans to create 430 jobs in 6 years, with an average salary of about $62,778, in return for about $9.3 million in state and Durham County incentives. President and CEO Madhu Berriwal says the company is on target to meet those growth projections. Although the federal budget cuts threaten the company's revenue stream, which have largely come from contracts with the public sector, Berriwal says there are still opportunities to gain clients and grow through acquisitions in a shrinking defense industry. The opportunity is there to shine as there are fewer contractors doing the work, and the ones doing the work have a greater ability to be seen, Barry Wall says. The company, founded in 1985, provides security services such as disaster management modeling and simulations, counterterrorism training, and cybersecurity measures. Prior to Hurricane Katrina, IEM led the development of a catastrophic hurricane disaster plan for Louisiana and New Orleans that projected disaster scenarios similar to Katrina. IEM has more than $25 million in revenue, but Bearwall adds the company's valuation is in excess of $50 million. From 2009 to 2010, revenue grew 10%, according to Bearwall. For 2011, Bearwall wants to accelerate the revenue growth by further firming its grip on public sector business. Although IEM has some private sector contracts, its biggest clients have come from the public sector. In May 2010, the company landed a five-year, $485 million contract with the U.S. Army to provide support services on the research and development of defensive nuclear explosive systems. The company has 300 full-time employees and 1,900 contractors nationwide. Among the open positions, the company is hiring for Java programmers and workers with backgrounds ranging from geography and urban planning to economics, biostatistics, and graphics. The company has more room to grow in the 2400 Ellis Road building, which has a total of 325,000 square feet. IEM currently occupies just the second floor of the building. Reichhold Incorporated shares the building with IEM and has the fourth floor and a section of the third floor, according to employee Joan Grace. The first floor is used for utilities and storage. Federal budget cuts are being watched closely by companies in the aerospace and defense industry. In last week's version of the federal budget, $11.6 billion was cut from military-related spending. In the S-1 filing of Booz Allen Hamilton, a defense and emergency planning company that went public in November, the company noted that the risks of budget cuts with federal funding comprising 98% of its revenue. In particular, the Secretary of Defense recently announced that he has directed the Department of Defense to reduce funding for service support contractors by 10% per year for the next 3 years, the company stated. A reduction in the amount of services that we are contracted to provide to the Department of Defense as a result of any of these related initiatives or otherwise could have a material adverse effect on our business and results of operations, end quote. Bearwall, who owns 100% of IEM, says the company is looking into acquiring businesses for growth and has no plans for a merger. Bearwall says she wants to build IEM to a $1 billion company, and she's not ruling out the possibility of going public in the next 2 years. We have to have a compelling story and sustained growth. We want to meet some internal goals before doing an IPO, she says. Next up, Charlotte Feels Bull City's Rush by Monica Chin. From Durham. Just a year after opening in downtown Durham, social entrepreneurship incubator Bull City Forward is expanding to Charlotte with its first satellite office, Queen City Forward. The new incubator is set to take 3,000 square feet in Packard Place, an entrepreneurship hub being renovated from an old car showroom and garage in uptown Charlotte. Fundraising and developing efforts are underway with an eye toward opening to members by the end of the year. Christopher Gergen, director and co-founder of BCF, says Queen City Forward will be the first step towards developing a statewide network of social entrepreneurship incubators, which would be the first of its kind in the country. Social entrepreneurs do business with emphasis on the triple bottom line, people, planet, and profit, seeking to benefit employees, communities, and the environment while having a profitable business. Having a network would help entrepreneurs connect with one another and to connect with new markets, Gergen says. It's the beginning of what we hope to be a statewide network of an entrepreneurial ecosystem driven by social change, end quote. I didn't anticipate it happening so quickly, but Charlotte has been such a terrific partner for us, Gergen says. Gergen says BCF could also expand into Raleigh, Chapel Hill, Greensboro, or Winston-Salem, Statesville and Greenville, as well as Wilmington and Elizabeth City on the coast. The idea behind it is a hub-and-spoke approach, Gergen says, so that entrepreneurs in a rural community can also have access to resources in the network. BCF provides resources, programs, and space to entrepreneurs in 5,500 square feet it has in the Crest Building, located on Main Street, downtown Durham. The incubator, which raised $100,000 last year for the initial launch, charges $25 a month for community membership and $75 to $250 a month for members to use the space. It currently has 102 members. BCF will celebrate its one-year anniversary on April 29th. The incubator opened last year with substantial support from Durham officials, economic developers, and business owners, with an executive committee that included Durham City Commissioner's Chairman Michael Page, Fayol Wynn, Vice President of Durham and Regional Affairs for Duke University, and Triangle Community Foundation President Andrea Bazin. Queen City Forward will launch with the same kind of top-level support, with Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox as chairman of an 18-person leadership board. The incubator is currently fundraising for $150,000, of which $25,000 has been committed. In June, strategic planning on membership and programs will begin. Sharon Lachow Bloomberg, a bakery owner and business consultant in Charlotte, is spearheading the strategic planning effort for QCF. Although many of the details have yet to be ironed out, Lachow Bloomberg says, "We're going to have a similar structure and approach as Bull City Forward, with a tiered membership organization. There has been a groundswell of enthusiasm and support for the concept," end quote. Packard Place, located at 222 South Church Street in Charlotte, is a 90,000-square-foot, five-story building originally constructed in 1928 as the showroom and parking garage for the Packard luxury car dealership. Currently, it's being renovated by business owners Dan Rossellini and Sarah Garces, a husband and wife team, into what they envision to be an entrepreneurship hub that would have a ground-level cafe and a 200-seat assembly hall. Tracy Dodson, Director of Economic Development for the Charlotte City's Planners, a business booster organization for Charlotte's Urban Center, says Packard Place and QCF will help diversify businesses in Charlotte from the financial industry to include more small businesses. "We want to grow other businesses here," she says, "and part of the thinking is that growing companies from the ground up is just as strong as recruiting them into the city." Durham's Ronald McDonald House plots a bigger footprint. By Jason DeBroom, from Durham. The Ronald McDonald House of Durham will nearly double its capacity through a $6.7 million expansion that will allow the facility to help more people like Ira Alfaro. At birth, Alfaro's daughter, Andrea, was diagnosed with Hurler syndrome, an inherited disease that prevents the body from breaking down sugar molecules. Andrea Alfaro has been in and out of the hospital for the first 3 years of her life, but thanks to the Ronald McDonald House, there has been a place nearby that the Alfaros, mother and daughter, could call home. "For me, it has been a blessing," says Alfaro, who is from Central America. "If it wouldn't be for the house, my daughter probably wouldn't have been so well. I don't have the money to be staying in an apartment or anywhere else," end quote. Now the Ronald McDonald House of Durham plans to add 28 suites in a 26,135-square-foot expansion that will bring the facility's total number of suites to 55. The project will include the addition of a court and parking on 6.51 acres of a 14.64-acre site at 506 Alexander Avenue in Durham. The nonprofit has already raised $4 million to pay for the construction, says Executive Director Bill Donovan, and he hopes to hit the $5 million mark before breaking ground, and an event he anticipates will take place this fall. The current house is already bursting at the seams. Its current rooms are always full, and the group has to turn away anywhere from 8 to 15 families every night, Donovan says. Upon completion, Donovan expects to be still at or near capacity every day, but the group will be able to help nearly twice as many people, he says. Although the Ronald McDonald House has no official connection to the Duke University or its hospital system, nearly all of its patients staying at or with families at the facilities are undergoing treatment at Duke. The Ronald McDonald House of Durham is a vital resource for Duke Children's Hospital, effectively serving as an extension of Duke Children's and fostering our activity as a regional and national center of excellence, says Dr. Joseph St. Germ, chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at Duke's Children's Hospital and Health Center, in an email. In order for Duke Children's Hospital to provide care for the increasing number of children and families from distant locations who require our services, it is critical that we have increased capacity at the Ronald McDonald House, end quote. Duke makes donations to the nonprofit, which operates on a roughly $1.2 million a year budget, and its athletic department routinely donates tickets for residents to attend sporting events. They are a major supporter, Donovan says. Patients whose families stay at the home often come from long distances to undergo specialized treatments. Last year alone, the group housed families from 7 countries, 37 states, and 87 of North Carolina's 100 counties. Residents receive care and made to feel as though they were at home. Families are asked to pay $10 to $15 per night for the accommodations, but that fee can be waived if families can't afford it. When you come to stay at Ronald McDonald House, you bring your clothes, and we take care of everything else, Donovan says. That includes foods, toiletries, transportation, everything, he says. The Durham House has game rooms as well as partnerships with YMCA to help provide a semblance of normalcy to residents. Next up, Nexen Pruitt pushes to raise profile with new hires, by Chris Basden. From Raleigh, South Carolina law firm Nexen Pruitt is making a major play to raise its profile locally by adding 4 new attorneys, including marquee names such as I. Beverly Lake, Gene Boyce, in its Raleigh office. The new recruits are Robin Vinson, who comes over from Raleigh-based Smith Anderson, Gene Boyce and his son Dan from Boyce & Isley, PLLC, and Lake, who has most recently worked at the boutique litigation shop Shanahan Law Group, PLLC. The new teammates bring a mix of benefits to the Columbia-based Nexen Pruitt, adding big names like Lake, a former Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court, and the 78-year-old Gene Boyce, who first made his bones in the legal world serving as the Assistant Chief Counsel to the Watergate Committee, should provide a boost to business development efforts. I think I can be helpful in that area, says the 77-year-old Lake, who will serve as senior counsel. Dan Boyce, 52, is a well-known local litigator. He will be a member, which is Nexen Pruitt's designation for what most firms call a partner. He and his father saw a large increase in the volume of work in their firm last summer, which helped contribute to their decision to join a bigger firm with more practice areas. With this larger platform, we can provide more backup support, says Dan Boyce, whose previous firm had just 4 attorneys, including his sister, Laura Boyce Isley, and her husband, Philip Isley. Laura is taking a sabbatical from lawyering, the Boyces say, while Phil, a former Raleigh City Councilman, is now working at the Raleigh firm Blanchard Miller Lewis and Isley, PA. Benson, who concentrates on areas such as health care, litigation, antitrust, and unfair competition, will take over as the local office's managing member. He previously spent 3 decades at Smith Anderson, which is a large local firm with about 115 lawyers, but which only has 1 office. I think it's great for Robin, Smith Anderson Chairman John Jernigan says when asked about Vincent's move. We are happy for him. The new hires bolster the business litigation capacity of Nexen Pruitt's Raleigh office, which now has a total of 14 attorneys. John Sowards, the firm's board chairman, sees great opportunities in the Triangle and indicates that he isn't done recruiting. We are looking to build a full-service office in Raleigh, says Sowards. Noah Hufstetler, the managing partner at Nelson's Mullis Raleigh office, says that adding high-profile attorneys will help the South Carolina firm build its brand identity in this region of the Tar Heel State. It's a positive for them, says Hufstetler, whose firm is also based in South Carolina. They've got some good people. And they aren't the only new hires. Litigator John Mabe came over from Williams Mullen in February. Nexen Pruitt also recently added marketers Laura Hudson, Merritt Atkins to its local staff of support personnel. The firm is short on associates locally, but can farm out some of the work to associates in other offices. Nexen Pruitt has more than 180 attorneys across 8 offices, including locations in Raleigh, Charlotte, and Greensboro. Next article, Despite Contraction Talks, Colleges Rake in Research Dollars, by Jason DeBrun, from Raleigh. North Carolina's public universities set a new record in research grant money they received last year, taking in more than $1.4 billion for sponsored program activity. The School of Medicine and the School of Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill received $803 million between them, more than all of the other universities combined at $803 million. Of that, $424 million went to the School of Medicine and $88 million to the School of Public Health. North Carolina State University took in the second most at nearly $266 million and posted a 29% increase when compared to the previous year. Funds tied to the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the stimulus bill, accounted for much of the increase in 2010 spending over 2009. When in UNC schools combined to receive $1.2 billion in grants. In all, the stimulus accounted for $199 million last year, but stimulus aside, UNC system schools were still awarded more in regular funding than ever before. It was another great year, says Stephen Leith, System Vice President for Research. We set another all-time record in total volume of research, which allowed us to do some of the interesting things that we couldn't do before, end quote. UNC Wilmington, for example, received $15 million from the National Institute of Standards and Technology to expand research facilities, something the school would likely not have been able to do if it relied only on state funding. We don't usually get money from them, Leith says of the NIST. He commended professors who have been asked to do more in the classroom, but were still able to put together 11,494 grant applications that totaled more than $6 billion in grant dollars. University officials are fully aware that banner years such as 2010 could become a thing of the past, given the cost-cutting mood in Congress. Where cuts ultimately are made is anyone's guess at this point, but Congress currently is considering slashing NIH funding by $260 million this year and the National Science Foundation's funding by $53 million. The UNC system's two largest universities, NC State and UNC at Chapel Hill, historically have taken different paths towards research applications. Chapel Hill has steadily grown its grant takeover the years, while NC State only recently has revved up its grant applications, accounting for the nearly $60 million increase in awards last year compared to 2009. The system has set annual records in most of the past 15 years, taking in $528 million in 1997 and breaking the $1 billion mark in 2004, a threshold it has achieved every year since. Awards came mostly from the federal government, which accounted for $928 million, 68% of the 2010 total. The National Institutes of Health was the largest single contributor, with $471 million in awards granted to UNC schools. Researchers at the universities branched out for some projects but stuck mostly to their bread and butter. UNCCH did a lot of cancer research, and NC State focused heavily on engineering. One of the major projects at NC State is the Future Renewable Electric Energy Distribution and Management, or FREEDOM, project, which is examining ways to improve connecting electricity generated by individuals on the power grid. Terry Lomax, NCSU's Vice Chancellor for Research and Innovation, explains that the U.S. model of energy flow goes almost primarily through a main source like Duke Energy. Researchers want to develop a way in which users can generate and share energy with each other. We are looking at how to manage the grid so it can flow both ways, she says. At Chapel Hill, researchers focused heavily on biomedical work, specifically looking for cures for various cancers and pulmonary diseases, says Dee Dee Corvinus, research director at the Office of Research in the UNC School of Medicine. Going forward, the UNC School of Medicine will continue to build on its existing strengths, as well as branch out towards studying obesity, which Corvinus calls probably one of the most important upcoming health care issues, end quote. At NC State, Lomax says researchers would look to branch out and try to find as many research opportunities as possible. Next up, North Carolina looks to add alcohol warehouse space, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh, can't find a bottle of the popular Skinny Girl Margarita at the local ABC liquor store or a favorite Scottish whiskey? The reason may be that the State Alcoholic Beverage Control Commission years ago reached capacity at its 200,000-square-foot warehouse on Tryon Road in Raleigh. State law requires that all spirits approved for sale in North Carolina must first be transported to the state-owned warehouse, from which it is distributed to the 168 local ABC boards and their more than 400 stores. Because warehouse space is so tight, popular and often profitable selections are delisted on a quarterly basis, state officials say, and many liquor options are available only by special order, by the case, and sometimes can take weeks to receive. But a short-term solution could be forthcoming. The state owns the existing ABC warehouse, but contracts management to a firm called LB&B Associates. The ABC Commission in March directed LB&B to find another bulk warehouse within 15 miles of the current warehouse, with at least 200,000 square feet of space for lease, doubling the space. The state's plan is to move top-selling items to the new warehouse space with a goal of expanding the inventory for both domestic and import products, says ABC Commission spokeswoman Agnes Stevens. Currently, the state is able to carry only a 30-day supply of domestic products and a 45-day supply of imports. That could be lengthened to a 45-day inventory for domestics and a 60-day inventory of imports with the additional warehouse building. The state warehouse currently carries about 1,700 different products, and expansion would allow it to boost selection by as much as 25%, Stevens says. We believe that leasing a second bulk warehouse to handle our top sellers is the best short-term solution to the capacity problem we've been facing for some years now, says Michael Herring, chief administrator of the ABC Commission. A 2007 expansion study commissioned by ABC outlined four options for expansion, including the purchase of a new property and construction of a new building, adding on to the current warehouse with a more efficient crane operation, or opening a second warehouse in the western part of the state. Construction of a new building could be an option in the future, Stevens says, but not in 2011. The goal is to take occupancy of the additional warehouse space by September. Craig Pleasant, general manager of the Wake County Board of Alcohol Control, says storage problems at the state ABC warehouse have been a problem for about 7 years. Skinny Girl Margarita is as hot as a firecracker right now, and they've been out of it for weeks, he says, referring to the premixed margarita drink spun out of the Real Housewives of New York City reality show by star Bethany Frankel. And if there's an item on sale, they can maybe hold 500 cases, but there's demand for 2,000, Pleasant says. In the last 3 years, he estimates the state has delisted nearly 300 items. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. Rebuilding Triangle, one house at a time. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. At Triangle Family Services, volunteers have been pitching in to improve the building the agency purchased 2 years ago on Western Boulevard in Raleigh. On April 1st, about 15 volunteers from the Leadership Raleigh Alumni Association gathered at the building, which Triangle Family Services occupied about a year and a half ago. Their assignment was to demolish what had served up as a break room and to spruce up some other rundown rooms. Since then, subcontractors hired by Rebuilding Together of the Triangle and paid through an $8,000 grant from Honeywell Building Solutions have been doing electrical and plumbing work at the building. And on April 30th, 25 to 30 volunteers from Honeywell, along with volunteers from Rebuilding Together, will gather at the building to handle chores ranging from flooring and painting to trim and carpentry work. The building is quite old and has a lot of things that need to be worked on, says Tiffany Melnick, agency coordinator for the Triangle Family Services. The Leadership Raleigh Alumni Association provided volunteers for its inaugural spring service day. Responding to a request for proposals from the Leadership Raleigh Group, the agency submitted a wish list for repair projects, including converting the building's old break room into a multifunctional service and therapy room, equipping a call center, and clearing the rear parking lot of debris from fallen trees to make more room for parking. Triangle Family Services also connected, by chance, with Dan Sargent, Executive Director of Rebuilding Together of the Triangle, a local affiliate of Washington, D.C. nonprofit Rebuilding Together that works to keep low-income homeowners stay safe and healthy in their homes. The nonprofit provides home repairs, modifications for people with disabilities, and weatherization, mainly through volunteer labor and donated funds. In 2010, for example, Rebuilding Together of the Triangle handled about 18 individual projects and plans to take on about 30 projects this year, including 2 to 3 nonprofits that serve the same constituency it serves. At a grant workshop sponsored by the City of Raleigh, Sargent met Jennifer Brown, Marketing and Development Coordinator for Mental Health and Family Safety Programs at Triangle Family Services. That initial conversation led to a partnership with Rebuilding Together of the Triangle enlisting Honeywell, which has a national relationship with Rebuilding Together's parent group. "We mobilize community resources to meet the needs in the community for housing," Sargent says. Jack Connell, energy sales leader for the South region of Honeywell's Building Solutions, which has an office in Morrisville, says the company is committed to supporting the communities we live and work in, and typically does 2 projects a year in the Triangle through Rebuilding Together, including another one this fall. Melnick of Triangle Family Services says the volunteer efforts on its behalf represent an affirmation to our staff to see that the community wants to partner with us and that multiple groups are taking these projects on, end quote. "It also is an affirmation to our clients," she says, "to see that the community is supporting us." And now from the opinion page. The guest opinion is now of Bob Moulton. Good call on SB 144. An important piece of legislation is currently in review by the Commerce Committee and appears to be on the way to approval. Senate Bill 144 will place the so-called cash converters under the same reporting regulations that the pawn industry has operated with since 1989. Cash converters operate in much the same way as pawn dealers. They purchase pre-owned merchandise for cash or a check. However, the simple name difference allows them to operate unregulated. The lack of oversight of the cash converter has created a possible haven for thieves to unload their stolen merchandise. Contrary to common public opinion, pawn stores take in very, very little stolen property because the criminals know that pawnbrokers are required to keep detailed records and report all of their purchases to the police. As a concerned citizen, you should demand that this legislation pass. If you had something stolen, would you want the police to look only at a very few places that buy used merchandise, or would you want them to look at all of them? Pawn store operators are required to request all pawn customers to provide proof of ID and to sign a contract stating that the item to be pawned or sold belongs to them. Copies of all documentation along with digital security recordings aid law enforcement in identifying suspects. Criminals know that they're basically turning themselves in if they come into pawn stores with something stolen. If an item is stolen, the person trying to pawn it is guilty of obtaining money by false pretenses, a serious felony. What thief would want to turn misdemeanor larceny into a felony? Taking in stolen items is bad for business, and modern pawn store owners train employees to spot suspicious items and behavior. In a case where suspected items are confiscated, the victim receives the property back, and a criminal goes to jail, but the store loses all money paid for the items. Thanks to inaccurate stereotypes in movies and televisions, some people still think pawn shops are dingy junk stores complete with shady proprietors dealing in stolen merchandise. However, today's modern pawn shop is a highly regulated, responsible member of the community. The National Pawnbrokers Association statistics report that approximately 0.1% of all items received by pawnbrokers nationwide are confiscated by police under suspicion of being stolen. Not proven, just suspected, which means that 99.9% of items are not. Any statistician will tell you that a number so small statistically is insignificant, and no other business dealing in secondhand merchandise can boast such numbers. I am not accusing cash converter type stores of dealing in stolen merchandise. I am only stating the facts. There are a lot of property crimes. Very, very little is turning up at pawn stores. It has to be going elsewhere. Where is it going? You will never know unless you check. This new law will give law enforcement the tools to do so. With the passage of SB 144, introduced to the Finance Committee on February 24, 2011, by State Senator Wesley Meredith, Republican, Blade and Cumberland County, along with 26 bipartisan co-sponsors, cash converters will be subject to the same reporting regulations under which the pawn industry operates. Many other states and municipalities across the country have already done this. I applaud the sponsors of this timely and important legislation for their vigilant efforts to thwart crime in North Carolina. SB 144 will protect the interest of law-abiding citizens and help to solve more property crimes. It should be known that Moulton owns the National Pawn in Durham and is president of the North Carolina Pawnbrokers Association. The good folks at law firm Nelson Mullins recently threw a birthday bash for managing partner Noah Hufstetler, who turned 60 on March 26th. Among the gifts was a drinking mug that proclaimed something along the lines of, "Life begins at 60." That sounded all well and good until the health care attorney looked at the fine print on the gift. Remember, young lawyers always read the fine print. Which said that this mug was decorated with lead paint and advised against drinking out of it. "I'm not sure if that was intentional or not," confesses Hufstetler, who speculated that the office staff might be trying to ease him into early retirement. Talk about the gift that keeps on giving. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is www.trianglereadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.